Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. If you're a regular listener, you know I am obsessed with coffee. My love affair with coffee started over 25 years ago. I drink it daily, I drink it early, and I drink it often. On a typical day, I'll have around 5 to 6 cups. Now, if I'm going to drink so much of something, I want to feel confident that it's good for my health. So you can imagine how freaked out I was when I found out that many coffee beans actually contain mold and microscopic toxins. Mold can form on coffee beans when they are grown, stored, or transferred in a moist, warm environment, and the supply chain of coffee makes it particularly susceptible to mold and the toxic chemicals called mycotoxins. According to some analysis, up to 50% of beans tested positive for mycotoxins, which can cause serious liver and kidney issues in high doses. Mycotoxins are almost impossible to see or taste, unlike the mold you might see from water damage in your house. And the effect that mycotoxin exposure has on humans isn't entirely clear, and there's a level of uncertainty that I, as a coffee lover, am just not comfortable with. I believe in compromise, but not when it comes to what I'm putting into my body. When I drink something so often, I want to know that I'm giving myself all the best possible benefits and not ingesting anything that is going to potentially negate all the other good stuff I'm doing. And once I learned about all the bad stuff like mold, mycotoxins, and other contaminants in coffee, I knew it was time to work on a better product. And I started asking myself the following questions. Would it be possible to source a USDA certified organic coffee that was high in polyphenols and had no mold, mycotoxins, pesticides, and heavy metals? And would we be able to test for all of the above? Could we find a coffee that meets all of our aforementioned standards and actually tastes great? No one wants to drink healthy coffee that tastes like crap. We want it to taste good. It took over a year, but we found a solution that delivers in full. Clean Coffee Plus. Our brand new coffee is handled in a way that reduces the risk of fungal growth and is rigorously tested for mold and mycotoxins, along with other nasties like pesticides and heavy metals. The testing that we do gives me confidence that the product I am drinking multiple times a day has nothing to hide. We test for an exhaustive battery of contaminants, 4 heavy metals, 10 microbial tests, 21 mycotoxins, 300 plus pesticides, and 20 solvents. I absolutely love our new Clean Coffee Plus, and I know you will too. So go to shop.mindbuddygreen.com/coffee20 to get 20% off your first order. You are going to love this coffee, and I really hope you try it. Anxiety can strike during unexpected times, and you're not always in a setting that calls for a 20-minute meditation or a few moments alone by yourself. That's why we have Dr. Jennifer Tates here to teach us the best, most underrated strategies to reduce anxiety in real time. I'm talking right now, in the moment, self-soothing tools that actually work. They're so quick, she even calls them a control-alt-delete for your nervous system. Jennifer is a licensed clinical psychologist, board certified in cognitive behavioral therapy by the American Board of Professional Psychology, and she specializes in evidence-based therapies, including DBT and CBT. And today, she's on the show to discuss all the actionable tips from her new book, Stress Resets, How to Soothe Your Body and Mind in Minutes. So what is your absolutely favorite in-the-moment strategy when stress invariably hits?
Jason, there are so many, but one of my favorites is anchoring, which entails planting your feet into the floor, doing a quick 3-point check. What am I thinking? What am I feeling in my body? What do I feel like doing? And then coming back to the moment. And one of the reasons this is one of my favorites is because so often we're not even aware of what we're thinking. We're not thinking, I can't, this is too much. We're not aware that we are tensing every muscle in our body and not taking deep breaths and reacting really impulsively. And if we take a quick inventory, we have so much information and ability to then improve kind of our thinking, physical sensations, and our behaviors.
So is that something we need to do over and over, or is, I'm assuming that takes a little practice?
It takes practice, and it's also something that takes milliseconds. So you can do this repeatedly, subtly, it also saves us so much time because we might not even realize that we're ruminating or we're doing something that we know we're going to pay a price for. And so constantly kind of having this attitude of checking in with yourself, really looking at whether what you're doing is helpful is the first path to freedom.
And so I'm going to use a real world example, which I've experienced, and I'm sure many of our listeners have too. It's late at night and we do the thing that we know we shouldn't do. And that's check our phone. We hear that sound, and it's a text, and it's before bedtime. And we open that, we look at the text and we open the text, and it's an unpleasant text, maybe from a family member, maybe a friend, maybe an ex, maybe who knows. But we look at that text and it's like, oh, and it's bedtime. Worst time. Walk us through that situation.
Jason, this is a little tricky because my book includes 75 resets. And so we often need to stack a bunch of these because I want people to really acknowledge that really hard times call for a lot. And so I think the first thing to do in that situation is to practice self-validation, which is normalizing. Of course, I feel really upset. Of course, this really frustrated me. Of course, I feel like I'm a little energized and not in the perfect spot that is going to allow me to relax, because I think what a lot of people inadvertently do is think, like, this is so frustrating, and then hit themselves with a second punch of like, I'm such an idiot for checking my phone. I shouldn't have done that. And so rather than kind of picking your emotional scab, normalizing like, okay, this is really hard. This is not what I expected. And then you can come back to the anchoring strategy of noticing what you're thinking, that you need to solve something big when maybe it's not something you can solve right now. Maybe you're starting to breathe from your chest rather than your diaphragm. Maybe you're starting to frantically send a response. And so to even just quickly do that and catch what you're about to do and then maybe do something different. There's a favorite song of mine that's in the book specifically for creating a serene environment within yourself. It's a song by Marconi Union called Weightless. And it really is very sedating. Like, you're not allowed to listen to this while you're driving because it will make you fall asleep. But, you know, maybe you do this mix of normalizing your feelings, anchoring, listen to Weightless.
That song Weightless. So Andrew Huberman has talked about that track. There's actually science behind this track. It is effective for reducing stress. Like, there was an experiment.
Yeah. So actually this song was one of the inspirations for me writing this book. So right in the middle of it's kind of the peak of the pandemic, I was talking to a colleague of mine at UCLA, and this was at a time that everyone was really struggling with stress. And there was a lot in the news about how difficult it was to access therapy at that time. And there were all these long wait lists, and even aside from waitlist, therapy can be really expensive. And a colleague of mine at UCLA years ago mentioned, hey, did you see this study that found that patients about to go into surgery, led by researchers, this was done at University of Pennsylvania, so pretty legitimate, patients about to go into surgery, half of them were able to listen to this song, Music Medicine, the song Waitlist by Marconi Union, and half of the patients received a benzodiazepine. And remarkably, the song had similar effects to the benzodiazepine, but of course, songs have no side effects. And this is really profound and powerful. And just thinking about this led me to write an article on quick ways we can all reset. And that became that article went viral in the New York Times. And that became kind of the inspiration for me expanding on that and writing this book.
What an unbelievable study. And I think about the implications. I think, wow, are we really underestimating the power of the placebo effect, the power of the human mind, the power of relaxation, the power of music? What's your takeaway when you? It's really unbelievable.
And I don't even know if it's placebo. I think we overreach and we go big and we think like more is more when it comes to stress relief. But remarkably, we're incredibly resilient and our own senses are unbelievable. They have so much power and a little goes a long way.
So on that note, I love how you talk about finding bite-sized doses of hope. This idea of a little goes a long way. I often hear, you know, hope is not a strategy in terms of stress. So I'm very intrigued by this idea of bite-sized doses of hope. Could you talk about that?
Sure. One tool I talk about in the book is creating a hope kit, just a small collection of things that inspires hope, whether that's a reminder to go take a walk outside, whether that's a greeting card someone wrote you with a really uplifting message, whether that's a picture of you surrounded by loved ones. And while this sounds like just kind of a nice idea, there is actually research that people who created a virtual hope kit were actually, it led to significant reductions in suicidality, wanting to die by suicide. And so often when we're in a certain state, when our emotions are very intense, we're just really narrowly focused on all of the things that are going wrong and zooming in on our problems and really missing the full perspective of how much more there is and better times and being able to quickly focus on the reminders that there's more than this moment and there's more than the pain is a really incredible way to both broaden how you feel in this moment and engender a little bit of hope.
That's tremendous. Can you describe what was in this hope kit?
So there's an app called the Virtual Hope Box app. And remarkably, this app was found to reduce feelings of suicidality. And this is something that anyone can download now. But if you want to just also quickly create one on your own, if you can put together a really personal collection of things that might give you a little bit of dose of positive feelings that you can lean on in those moments when you start to feel really stuck and when rumination starts to take over or you find yourself replaying all of the horrible things that have happened and anticipating all of the horrible things that will happen. And while this may seem silly, it's incredibly powerful to see bigger in those moments when we're drowning.
And so, unfortunately, sometimes when we are drowning, we go to our phone. Intuitively, unfortunately, it just kind of happens. And then we go to social media, probably not the place we should go. And social media can be wonderful. And sometimes there's incredible advice from experts like yourself. And other times they're just people sharing advice that's probably not so good. And I will call out TikTok on this one. I'm curious, what have you seen on TikTok or more generally one of the social media platforms in terms of techniques or tactics that could be employed when someone's stressed, where you're saying to yourself, oh no, please don't do that. Stay away.
I love that you're asking this question. One of the ones that I noticed a lot last year was bed rotting, which is something that I believe amassed 2 billion views.
Bed rotting?
Bed rotting, rotting in your bed.
That doesn't sound like it's going to help my stress level.
This is, yeah, it's kind of what it sounds like. The advice is if you're feeling really overwhelmed, get cozy in your bed and almost like move into your bed and eat there, or lounge there, don't bother getting up. And this is so upsetting to me. Terrible, terrible. It's actually, I would say that bed rotting is probably a prescription for depression because we know that behavioral activation or doing things that increase your activity level so you do more things that allow you to experience pleasure and a sense of accomplishment, doing behavioral activation actually works as well as antidepressants for severe depression. And so rotting your bed is asking to stay depressed and get worse. And I really, it's also interesting to note that taking a week-long break from social media, which I know might seem difficult, but is worth trying because that is has been found to improve well-being. And so I certainly want people to really think twice about what can I put in my hope kit that I can lean on instead of clinging to my phone and doing the same things that I've done that have never proven rewarding.
You know, that's just so terrible. Pretty much every expert we've ever had on this subject, as we talk about, you know, mental health and when someone's spiraling, the science is unequivocally clear. Like exercise helps. The challenge there is when you're really down in the dumps, it's hard to pull yourself up. Like things are really dark, to actually get yourself to get out and move. And so we'd be a lot better served if there was a trend on TikTok about how to pull yourself up out of bed when you're just feeling lousy and it's dark and you're spiraling versus it's okay, let's just stay here and eat and
I'm with you there. Yeah. I'm with you there. And I think even the word pull yourself up seems really hard. And the word that I love to use is like practice willingness. Like, are you willing to be a little uncomfortable in the service of changing your life, changing your day, changing your mood?
I like that you mentioned willing to be uncomfortable. It seems to be a theme that's come up on the show recently, this idea that we may be a little bit too comfortable. You know, I just interviewed Michael Easter the other day, who we were talking about his most recent book, but his prior book was The Comfort Crisis. And it's this idea that we have become a little bit too uncomfortable. And I'll use an example I've used many times in the show, that, you know, the cold plunge, the ice bath, this idea of getting out of our comfort zone, even if just for a couple minutes, is powerful. So can we spend a little bit more time about what's going on in the brain with our mindset when we are willing to take on those challenges that are difficult?
Yeah, we all, I think, often just instinctively put a premium on what feels good short term at the expense of what feels long term. And so even just having like a quick list of the pros and cons of like doing something that feels really difficult, whether that's getting started on it to do at work or a really difficult project or going to the gym when you feel really unmotivated and tired. What are the pros of doing that? What are the cons? What are the pros of pushing it off to another day? What are the cons? Because we zoom in on instant gratification rather than thinking about the delayed rewards. And I want people to really remember that the best feeling in the world is self-efficacy, like knowing that I show up for myself and I can count on myself. And hope, coming back to hope, is not just a feeling. It's realizing that you can do hard things and that you can cope with whatever comes your way. And so by kind of having the mindset that this is not about how I feel right now, but this is an investment in my long-term well-being, that can kind of help us move a bit closer. But I think having a plan ahead of time so you're not making decisions moment to moment based on intense emotions, but planning ahead of time so you're really leaning into wisdom. One of the things in my own hope kit, one of the things when I feel really like fatigued and defeated or I got bad news or something, one of the things that I pull up is shortly after having my third child, I was feeling really down and struggling probably with a bit of postpartum depression. And I just felt like between sleep deprivation and being back at work, I had like very little joy in my life. And I thought, you know, what would I do if I felt like my best self, or this was the, you know, 6 month window of time that I was going to be pursuing my dreams. And I thought, you know what, I've always wanted to run the marathon. Maybe I should entertain that. And that seemed so crazy because I was exhausted. I had just given birth and I hadn't run since high school, which was many years prior to this time. And while it was incredibly exhausting, training and going from not being able to jog a block to, you know, completing 26.2 miles, that was the best thing I've ever done. One of the best things I've ever done. It really changed the way I see myself and the way I see what I'm capable of, even if my mind sends me messages of I can't or it's impossible. And so we really need to have this, and I'm not prescribing that everyone should be running the marathon. This was something that I was really had always dreamed of. But I think to really think about like, would I rather be comfy in this moment or would I rather change the way I view myself and the way I view my life?
Well, I think it's such a fantastic question you were able to ask yourself and ultimately execute on. And what would I do in 6 months if I were at my best? I think that's a great way to kind of pull yourself out of the now and the pain and the stress and the anxiety and operate from an abundance mindset to some degree that's aspirational. And then I think the rub there is, well, then what do you do next? How do you make sure? What did that look like? Obviously, you had to train, but like, what were you telling yourself on a daily basis? And, you know, congratulations, like marathon is serious and that's a big commitment. Other than obviously running, like how did you mentally get yourself there?
A big thing that I talk about in Stress Resets is focusing on your values. And so when I decided that this is something that I wanted to do, I quickly signed up to run for suicide prevention. And so knowing that like this wasn't about me, this was because I cared about suicide prevention, and knowing this wasn't about perfection and meeting any sort of time goal, but this was just about one step at a time, literally, and not letting my mind or my physical comforts dictate my next move. And so, yeah, just this sense that this was about something so much bigger, and I was so willing to accept anything in the service of a broader hope for the world.
I think it speaks to the power of purpose. You know, if you're not feeling great about yourself or maybe down, a great way to kind of do a reset is to, it's not volunteering per se, but help someone who's in a worse situation than you are.
Right. And this also comes back to this point that you need to kind of weave these together, and you need to really stack the resets because they work best in kind of an orchestra.
Just like building a habit.
Yeah.
So we talked about cold plunge, and I want to segue to something I read from you, which I thought was interesting. We talk about cold therapy so much here, but something I haven't heard, this is a new one for me, vagus nerve icing. What is that?
One of the tips in dialectical behavior therapy, which is a therapy that I specialize in, is called TIP, which is an acronym that stands for temperature, intense exercise, progressive muscle relaxation, and paced breathing. And so if you want the equivalent of like control, alt, delete, but for your brain and body, TIP is your new friend. And so TIP is a specific practice where, again, like a lot of us are reaching for things outside of ourselves that are fancy and have downsides. These are the things that I'm recommending from DBT are things that are within reach and affordable and a little uncomfortable, but really speak to the power of our own innate reset buttons. And so in DBT, the specific ice plunge is dipping your face in ice water, because when you hold your breath, I should also say you need to hold your breath when you do this. So you would set a timer for 30 seconds, hold your breath, submerge your face in the like a salad bowl full of ice water. Doesn't need to be too cold, but hold your breath for 30 seconds in the ice water. When a human body is submerged, specifically their nose underwater, that activates the mammalian dive response that lowers your heart rate. It redirects blood flow from non-essential to essential organs. Just very practically, it's going to be very difficult for you to be kind of worrying or replaying the same upsetting thing that happened while you're so physically shocked. And so doing this is just a very powerful way to kind of quickly come out with a new perspective and feeling of like, also this is a tiny dose of this realization that it's okay to not be uncomfortable, and you can do things that don't feel good, but that actually ultimately make you feel refreshed. So the temperature is one piece of it. But again, this is 30 seconds. You don't need to go to some fancy cold plunge place. You don't need to build a cold plunge. This is just an ice plunge for your face. And for people that don't maybe have access to ice, you know, even an ice roller could, it's not going to create the same effects, but it could kind of help a little bit with grounding yourself with the cold as a way to sort of, you know, cool you down, and metaphorically and literally. And then the intense exercise is similar. It's just like 90 seconds of, you know, burpees or squat jumps or something that feels comfortable to you, but that brings up your heart rate. And that is the kind of thing that you can't be thinking or multitasking in your mind while doing the activity. And then progressive muscle relaxation, tensing, you know, for example, tensing your forehead and then releasing, and then noticing the difference between tension and relaxation in your forehead, tensing your lips by pursing them together, releasing so there's some comfortable space between your upper and lower teeth, and continuing throughout your body to do this for a couple minutes. I know that there are some versions of this that span like 20 minutes, but this, you could do a quick version in just a few minutes, and then slowing your breathing, and all of these things together will quickly change how you feel, quiet your mind, slow your heart rate, give you a taste of accomplishment.
Essentially, their state changes.
Exactly. And again, these are within us. We can do this.
Yeah. No, what I love too about your book and your resets, many of them are real-time tools. You know, you don't need to necessarily set aside a half hour or go somewhere. It's just, I can do this right now. I could, if push came to shove, I could go in my freezer and grab a big bag of frozen broccoli and just smash it on my face for...
Yeah, put that in some water, hold your breath, submerge, and there you are. And Jason, I love that you said that, because I just thought that the concept of a book on stress was so ironic. Who has time when they're stressed to like sit down and do a deep dive into, you know, the physiology of stress or the complexities or how bad stress is for you? Most of us, reading a book is something that we do and we have a lot of time, and when we're relaxing, not when we're highly stressed. And so the whole purpose of this book is almost like a cookbook. You can turn to any page and find something that meets you where you're at, and it's experiential. And so it's not just reading about something, especially something about how scary and terrible stress is for you, but actually what can you do and how exactly, like what's the manual for moving forward and knowing that this is something that you can make part of your repertoire.
Exactly. I think most people who experience stress are most interested in how they can alleviate it or better manage it. Not necessarily all the things that are happening physiologically, which are interesting. Tell me what I can do. I feel it. I get it. It's real. Help me.
Exactly.
Can you talk a bit more about DBT?
Dialectical behavior therapy, or as we call it, DBT, is a therapy that basically teaches you how to become your own therapist. It teaches a set curriculum. So rather than therapy being this, you come in and you do all the talking, in DBT, a therapist actually teaches you how to be more mindful, how to manage your emotions so you feel like they're more on a dimmer system than an on-off switch. It's the emotion regulation unit. How to tolerate distress without making things worse, and how to be more interpersonally effective, how to be able to ask for what you want, say no, meet your goals while also maintaining relationships. And so people that pursue DBT learn these tools, and these are tools that so often I hear people tell me that they wish they learned in school. And then they have these tools at their disposal. So we're kind of leveling the playing field, where what I know, you don't have to come for weekly sessions for the rest of your life to have a manual to do better and live better.
How long is the training typically?
To do DBT skills training, that takes about 4 months. But a lot of experts have found in research trials that repeating it twice, because there's something about repetition that really consolidates and makes something more muscle memory. So you could do it for 4 to 8 months.
Got it. That's actually pretty quick if you think about all the applications and the need for this. You mentioned the power of saying no. In my experience, I found that this is a big one, that there are many people who really have difficulty saying no. And that means they either say yes, or oftentimes, like, just if it's written communication, won't respond. Like the art of the polite no, they're just incapable. So can we talk about that one? I feel like I've seen it over the past few years. I think when done correctly, the very polite no can almost result in having more respect for someone than a yes. And there's an art to it. So let's just spend a moment on how to say no, the lost art of saying no.
One of the most painful things that we could ever experience is ghosting, like someone not even responding. And it's really hurtful if someone makes a request of you to not even respond. And so I think we need to look at why people might not say no. And I think a big reason is emotional avoidance, like being uncomfortable with your own experience of guilt, shame, anxiety, not knowing what someone is going to respond. And really considering, am I willing to feel some of these feelings to be the sort of person that makes someone else feel heard, or that makes someone else feel seen? And sure, saying no can be uncomfortable and unpleasant, but not responding is so much worse and so disrespectful. And I'm a big fan of coping ahead, or like planning ahead and doing things to help yourself. And so if you want to save a couple of good scripts. I truly work with people on literally scripting out some of these. And then once you've mastered a couple, it's easier for them to come spontaneously or for them to generalize. And even if you feel like you can't do this in the moment, even asking for a minute and coming back, but we need to make sure that we do come back. And I think communicating no with tremendous kindness and being willing to sit with someone, even if they feel disappointed or they have something, some sort of response to try to convince you, is a way to learn that there's a lot in terms of relationships. You can disappoint someone and the relationship will continue.
What's an example of a great no?
These are so situation specific, and it's so interesting just in terms of—
And we could choose, you know, going to dinner, we could choose travel, we could choose any example you think is you've seen in your work, which comes up frequently, we can go with. But I'd love to just give our listeners like a real world, here's how to do it like a pro.
Yeah, perfect. And so when I was living in New York City, I would often hear from clients that people coming to town wanted to crash in their place. And being New York City, a lot of people maybe don't have a lot of space, and a studio is not a great place to have someone cohabitating with you, even if it's just for a couple of days. And so, again, I think we need to take a step back and think about like how disruptive not telling someone quickly that you can't accommodate them is, because then they can't find somewhere else to potentially stay. They miss out on hotel deals. They're left stressed and worrying, whereas giving them certainty would allow them some clarity and power to pursue other opportunities. And so a great no for that would be saying like, hey, you know, I'm really happy that you asked about staying with me. I can't wait to see you when you're in town. My apartment is super small and I've been struggling with my sleep lately. And so I think it'll be hard for you to spend the night, but I'd love to take you to grab a bite to eat when you're in town. Or I'm also happy to recommend a couple of my favorite places to stay that seem pretty affordable.
Fantastic example. All of our New York City listeners are going to be very happy, because that one I know comes up quite frequently. Something else I love from you, which was unexpected. You wrote an essay in the Wall Street Journal titled "The Positive Power of a Good Sigh." Tell us more.
Again, we often reach for things outside of ourselves to feel better quickly, but there we are blessed with so many internal mechanisms to improve how we feel. And doing something as simple as taking a deep inhale and then taking a subsequent inhale. So you're taking two back-to-back inhalations, and then taking a long extended exhale releases a lot of carbon dioxide and can reset your breathing pattern. And so doing this a couple of times, experts at Stanford found that practicing sighing in this way, two inhales, extended exhale, back to back in a cycle, so you're repeating it several times to up to 5 minutes worth. Doing this, actually, people that did this in the morning, they had improved positive emotions and less anxiety. And you don't want to overdo this, because you don't want to be, you know, sighing all day long. That can replicate feelings of hyperventilating. But if you're stressed out, if you're in traffic, if you're about to go into a difficult meeting, two inhales, a long exhale releases a lot of the carbon dioxide that we associate with anxiety. And I think this is also just a nice way to recalibrate your respiratory rate. So you can do that and then shift into slow breathing, which is something that you can do most of the day. That has no side effects, that lowers your blood pressure and creates a calm alertness that we all need.
I love the classic inhale for two, hold, exhale for four, on repeat and rinse, or rinse and repeat. So of all the techniques, are there any that come to mind where you think like, wow, this is they're just underappreciated, underrated? Why aren't we talking about this?
Yeah, it's like picking a favorite child. I mean, I love all of these tools, and these are tools that—
You've got three, right?
I have three, yes. Three. Yeah, these are skills that I practice all the time myself personally, but I think one that might be underrated or something that people might not lean on and think is like a second best choice when it actually might be a first best choice is a skill called radical acceptance. A lot of people think like if they can't change something, then they should accept it. But I think radical acceptance is something that we can approach our whole lives with, whether we're radically accepting difficult situations, difficult people, thoughts. Radical acceptance is wholeheartedly noticing when you're judging, noticing when you're fighting with your body, like tensing up or doing the equivalent of saying hell no to whatever you're dealing with, and instead replacing judgments with just accepting and allowing what is, and relaxing your face and body and approaching life with kind of a hell yes attitude can make things that feel really painful less likely to create suffering.
Is there an example you can share on this one, whether it's personally or with someone you've worked with, to really paint the picture?
Yeah, I mean, radical acceptance is something we have to do all the time. And so even as something, I was talking to a client yesterday, and even as something as like radically accepting your anxiety, if you feel really anxious, it's human nature to think like, hell no, I don't want this. Get the hell out of here. Like, do not disturb. But if we put out a welcome mat for our anxiety and it's like, okay, here it is. Like, I'm going to carry you with me as I do the things that I want to do. If I'm stressed about traveling this holiday season, if I'm stressed about to do that feels really tough to tackle, if I really kind of embody what I would do if I was fully leaning into this. And this isn't easy, but moment to moment doing this. And so, yeah, radical acceptance is everything. A lot of times we're partially accepting, we're kind of doing work haphazardly while we're browsing the internet. We're accepting a difficult person while thinking what a jerk they are. But radically doing this is where you reap the most benefits. And it's really difficult, but it's also really relieving.
So you mentioned browsing the internet. Any strategies for someone who's kind of maybe ruminating or overthinking? How can we break that cycle or just avoid it altogether?
One simple solution is replacing why thoughts, like why me, why didn't this work out, why, which is a circular kind of dead end, with how, like how can I move forward? How can I make things better? So really replacing something that's unproductive with something that's a bit more constructive. Another strategy would be to like put yourself on a plan. If you tend to be thinking all day long, almost like a news ticker is running in your mind and stealing joy from your life, if instead you have a set time that you unpack the things that tend to take up a lot of space when you can't properly think about them. So, you know, pick a time that's convenient for you, not first thing in the morning when you need to be getting out the door, not right before bed when you want to wind down, but say like 4 to 4:20 is your time to think about, you know, how to move forward with a career opportunity or deal with something that's really disappointing in your personal life. So you're not kind of multitasking, because too many of us overestimate how much we can multitask, and no one can actually multitask well.
Well, I think that's interesting, because anxiety for many people stems out of this feeling of having a lack of control. And if you start like scheduling time in your day to deal with things, you're taking back control to some degree.
Exactly. And you're moving something from an all-day habit to like a set amount of time. And you're also shifting your relationship from something that that grips you to something that you're, you know, molding, becomes, you know, goes from something that's like in charge of your life to something that you're in charge of. Hmm.
You know, something else I've seen over the years is orthorexia and this health anxiety, where, you know, it's so great that people are becoming excited about health, but it can also become a bit too much, where they're focused on optimizing. And, you know, I've got the wearables, I'm wearing two of them, I love them, they work for me. But for some people, it leads to more stress, and then they're stressed about what they can eat. And perhaps they've been on an elimination diet. They just keep on eliminating and not adding or putting back. And then they're not eating anything, and they can't go to dinner because it's stressful. And it can put a lot of pressure on someone to optimize every little thing. How does one avoid going down that rabbit hole. And I know there's some generalizations we have to make because we're all wired differently here, where some people just have it a little bit more inclined to go all the way and unable to modulate or moderate or become, you know, have any sort of sense of like moderation. But I'll pause there and curious your thoughts.
Well, yeah, with the holidays that a lot of people are in my practice have been talking about struggling with, feeling like they're having to do all sorts of social things that are taking them away from maybe their exercise routine or introducing them to foods that they normally try to avoid. And so again, coming back to radical acceptance, really realizing that it's okay to skip a couple of exercise days if you're with family and you'd rather prioritize family. And that doesn't mean that you're going to be off the wagon and not able to come back on when you return. And I also think a very powerful tool that I talk about in the book is creating a pie chart of your life where you list all of the domains that matter to you. So let's say that's health, family, friends, career, personal growth, you name it, giving back to society, and also depict how much relative weight each represents. And so I think a lot of people that struggle with orthorexia or other disordered eating tend to overvalue shape and weight or health at the expense of other facets of their lives. And it's interesting because even health, like being really rigid about what you're doing, is maybe being really perfectionistic about health. And so we don't want to just say like my health doesn't matter. It's you're going the extra mile, and we don't want health to trump the rest of the things that matter to you. And so I think really working on accepting that life isn't perfect and you can't always optimize for nutrition and your perfect workout. And that doesn't mean that you can't go back. And also that the key tool in mental health is actually psychological flexibility and being really flexible, aware, open, willing to do things in the service of your values rather than being really rigid. And so it's interesting, but even, you know, people that struggle with extreme rigid behaviors, the part of the treatment for them is making them do things that are a little different.
I think that's fantastic. Something my wife and I talk a lot about is this idea, if you're going to be rigid about being flexible.
I love that. I love that. I'm going to use that.
I'm glad you like that. It means a lot coming from you that you like that, given your expertise and credentials. On the subject of radical acceptance and nutrition, how can radical acceptance be applied to emotional eating?
So many ways. I mean, radically accepting our emotions, radically accepting our urges. So we might think like I want more, and that not accepting it means having more, but radically accepting it's okay to want more, and urges are like waves. They come and go. We don't need to act on urges to eliminate them, that if we accept them and broaden our awareness, they will pass on their own without indulging. And so yeah, radical acceptance is key. Also accepting our current shape and weight, because the more frustrated we are with our shape and weight, the more likely we are to do things that ultimately backfire, like go on rigid diets and then end up overeating.
What's this idea of acknowledging it's here, that this desire is here? I'm acknowledging it. Doesn't mean I'm acting on it, but I'm acknowledging it's here.
Right.
And something else I've spoken about on this show is the mindset here. So I'll use a donut as an example. I'm a big fan of donuts. It's reframing how we think about the donut. We'll often hear it's cheat day, or I'm going to cheat. I prefer treat in terms of mindset. We flip from operating from a place of scarcity, shame potentially, when it's cheat, guilt, versus treat, where we're operating from a place of abundance, joy, celebration. And I don't know if there's any science here to support this. There may be some, but my feeling is how you think about that donut will determine actually how you absorb that donut in your body, so to speak, and the impact it has on you. That's my take. What do you think about that?
Yeah, for people listening, I'm smiling from ear to ear because I also love donuts and my approach is a little different. My kids love donuts. And so like we're happy to buy a donut and divide it into quarters and really mindfully eat a quarter of a donut, which actually is fine. It's kind of a middle path. A lot of us think like, oh, I'm abstaining or I'm indulging. We don't radically accept that we could experience a lot of delight without large quantities. And in terms of the research, interestingly enough, when people think that they're breaking a diet rule, they do tend to overeat in the aftermath. And so reframing and thinking that this is okay makes you feel less guilty, which can easily lead to then soothing your guilt with ironically more food.
Got it. And you know, it's also the idea, if you're going to have a donut, have an incredible donut. Don't just have a crappy donut. Probably shouldn't do it every day, but when I have a donut once a week, brings you joy, have at it. I want to come back to, you mentioned postpartum depression. How do you think about the new pill approved to treat it?
I don't know tons about it, but I want there to be more. I've read about it, but I'm not a psychiatrist, so I don't prescribe medication. So I'm not as familiar with all of the risks and rewards, but I do know that it's quite expensive. But I do want people to know that if for whatever reason they can't access that specific medication, that there are a lot of behavioral tools they can lean on. And I also want to normalize, like not sleeping is really depressing. And so to just even see that it's a natural byproduct of being exhausted to feel pretty lousy and be a magnet for negative thinking, that alone could give you a little bit of relief of not taking your thoughts so seriously and normalizing that anyone would feel the way you do. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not a bad parent. You're not a bad person. You're just exhausted and you can feel better and you will feel better, and don't judge yourself in the meantime.
And I'm assuming it's probably a good thing that we're having this discussion. Postpartum depression is out there. People are sharing. People are talking about it. 20 years ago, this wasn't necessarily the case. Women were suffering in solitude, but there's a conversation. This is real.
Exactly. And a lot of the relief may come from behaviors rather than more proactive behaviors rather than passively consuming, talking about it, asking for more help, not feeling like you have to hide this. Like we're doing this. So this is perfect that we're talking about it. But I want people to realize that there's a whole array of things that they can lean on if for whatever reason they don't want to take a medication.
So segueing to, you know, larger suffering, there's a saying I'm sure everyone's familiar with, misery loves company. And it is important to be able to vent sometimes. It is important to share when you're struggling. But then in certain situations, it can kind of cross a line where it's just too much and it becomes unproductive and it becomes a little bit too, I'll just leave it at unproductive. How do you think about that fine line as it is important to share, to vent, but then being able to flip the switch to being action-oriented?
There's a technical term called co-rumination, or it's possible to ruminate aloud with someone else, like two people just venting and getting angry. And I see a lot of my clients do this around like dating frustrations when they go out with a friend rather than enjoying the time together. They're kind of bemoaning lack of manners and the bad behavior and getting riled up. And that's very understandable. And the feelings are totally to be expected given the triggers. But rather than co-ruminating or spreading your stress, I think it's a matter of really taking a step back and thinking about like what sharing would be helpful. And at what point does it no longer serve me? Because if I'm going out with a friend, if I spend the whole time talking about like the bad highlight reel from the week, that might be a missed opportunity to really be present, enjoy the food, have a break from some of that, feel less lonely. And so, you know, with clients, I try to be really strategic. When someone comes to see me, they get a few minutes to complain, but then we quickly kind of need to honor the emotions and move into problem solving or skills to move forward, because I think a lot of people think that it's cathartic to just go on and on, but it's actually terrible for you and the people around you.
So is there a self-assessment one can do? Because we've all done this where okay, it's okay to vent. It is cathartic, but you know, if you do it to, if you're sharing the same story with more than two people or four people, I'm making this up, like you've crossed over to being unproductive. Like, do you have is there a self-assessment one can do here?
I think this might be on a case-by-case basis, because I imagine someone that's grieving or someone that doesn't have a lot of people to talk to might need to spend a little bit more time with one person on something. But I think to ask yourself, like, what amount of sharing would be useful to me? And then at what point do I want to turn things over? And maybe to even, I think it's also a real gift to tell people what you need. Like, hey, I just want you to listen and make me feel like my feelings make sense, rather than play devil's advocate or give me your advice, because I think it might go on and on because you're not getting what you need.
Let's talk about that for a moment, the lost art of listening. Because oftentimes when it's a friend or loved one and they're going through something, they're just looking for someone to listen. And I found from personal experience, I'm a very solutions oriented person who will, in the past, I've quickly gone to, well, we can do this. I try to solve problems. And someone who I love or care about has a problem or hurt, and right away I'm searching for solutions, and they actually don't want to hear that. I'm not helping. So how do we become better listeners or better friends, better partners, spouses, family members when we're in that situation?
I think asking someone, would you like me to listen, or would you like me to offer advice, and checking in with someone, because we're not mind readers and different people need different things in different situations. And it's so thoughtful, just the same way when you go to a restaurant, you tell someone if you want things, you know, mild or spicy. We need to ask people what they want and let them tell us and be able to be flexible and respond based on what's needed. But I think, to your point, I think many people tend to go into problem solving mode or advice giving. And again, part of this might be due to struggling with being around someone that's having a hard time, because that can be stressful and our emotions can be contagious. But I think thinking about one of the most powerful things we can give is our undivided attention. And at the end of the day, I think all of us just have a simple goal, a profound goal, both simple and profound, of feeling seen and heard. And doing that is such a gift. And so it's worthwhile to feel a little uncomfortable and not have anything to say to honor someone's experience and allow them some company in a hard moment.
Very sound advice. And I want to talk about emotions and how they're contagious in the positive light. You know, we all know that person who just, when they enter the room, they're smiling and they have energy and you want to be around them and they're great. And even when they're having a bad day, there's just something about them where, you know, they shrug it off and they're just a joy to be around. And of course, that person does have bad days and there are exceptions, but there's just something about this person that they're magnetic, and it's contagious. You like being around them. What have you found? Like, I think all of us would like to have a little bit more of whatever that person brings. How can we be more magnetic, more joyful, and just a better person to be around?
So many skills in the book that cover this. Being more grateful is certainly inspiring to other people and good for you, and allows other people, if you sort of start a conversation where you lead with gratitude, that makes others feel more grateful and then everyone feels happier. So gratitude is a big one. I think being energetic is really uplifting to the people around you, and we can actually like manufacture like energy and purposefully if we feel really defeated, but if we purposefully kind of try to be a little bit more enthusiastic and engaged in conversations, you know, it's so easy to imagine someone tells you that they got good news or something worked out well for them, to just, you know, kind of say, oh, good for you, versus like a really effusive, sympathetic, joyful, like this was, you know, the person that you cared most about having this thing come true. And so there's a lot of things we can do, from being grateful to really celebrating, to being really energetic, to really listening. All of those things can create kind of a positive cycle.
You can never underestimate the power of enthusiasm. It really goes so far.
For you and the people around you. Acting energetic will give you more energy, will improve your mood, and will make you more likable.
So you can't just sit in your bed all day, whatever that TikTok trend is. Just, oh, guys, still can't get over that one. Do not do that. I'll stop talking about it. So in addition to picking up the book, Stress Resets, which I highly recommend, I love all the practical tips and tricks because stress comes and got to figure out how to deal with it. We can all be better there. Is there anything we should all do today that we should incorporate in our day-to-day to just help us be better, be happier, be more resilient when stress invariably hits?
We all need to remember that emotions come in waves. Things will get better. And one of the big goals in resetting is not just to improve how you feel, but also to be of service to the people around you. And just how a little goes a long way for us to improve our mood. Something as simple as telling someone that you care about them or are thinking of them can truly change their lives and save their lives. And so I want people to remember that they can quickly recalibrate and that you can also create a positive ripple effect in the people around you.
Well said. We covered a lot of ground today. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you'd like to, or perhaps leave any words of wisdom with our audience?
I guess words of wisdom would be almost like, you know, a big suitcase, you know, like tiny wheels on a big suitcase. A moment of awareness and a doable strategy can truly make what feels overwhelming more doable.
Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you for all that you do to spread hope and relief and wellness to so many people.
Well, thank you. You're very kind.